Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing a new Frontline documentary called Yemen's COVID Cover-Up. Today's guest, Nawal Al-Mahafi, is originally from Yemen. She's been covering the devastating war for the past 6 years. She was the first journalist from an international outlet to be allowed into the country since the COVID pandemic began, and what she found was devastating. She visited hospitals and clinics and interviewed doctors, nurses, and people on the street about how they've been affected by COVID. Yemen was facing the worst humanitarian crisis in the world before the pandemic, and it just made it worse. A nurse who runs a clinic that treats malnourished children told her, all of these countries are desperate to find a vaccine. Can't they find a vaccine to end this war? Nawal Al-Mahafi is a Frontline correspondent and an award-winning reporter and filmmaker, and you can find a link to watch her documentary, Yemen's COVID Cover-Up, at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Nawal. Thank you so much for making this important film to you and your team, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for highlighting it. It's a pleasure.
Well, this is a big question, but I have to say we have not done a show about Yemen in some time now. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch to remind everyone why this has been so devastating in Yemen for the past 6 or so years?
Of course, and I'll try and make it as brief as possible, but it is a really complicated conflict. So really all started in 2015 when a Saudi-led coalition started bombing Yemen. And the reason why they did that is a few months earlier, this rebel group called the Houthis had stormed the capital Sana'a and basically invaded state institutions and held the president prisoner in his own home. So he fled to Saudi Arabia and he asked for them to intervene. And for the last 6 years, they've been bombing Yemen in order to restore the official government back to the capital city. Now, a lot has happened over the last 6 years. The Houthis, this rebel group, have become incredibly strong. They now control most of the country. They have been able to recruit. They've become very, very powerful in the last 6 years. The government is still in exile in Saudi Arabia, so they haven't been reinstated. And so not much progress has been made in the conflict for the government.
Can you just give us some more information about who the Houthis are? Because you actually interviewed a Houthi health minister.
So the Houthis are a like a tribe that come from the far north in Yemen, from a place called Sada. And, you know, before this war began, they were only around 20,000 men, but they have grown in numbers throughout this conflict. And that's mainly because they marched all the way to the capital. And then when they made it to the capital city, they started responding to people's grievances in the capital. So at the time, when the president was still there was subsidies lifted off of aid, which meant that all the prices for everything skyrocketed when these subsidies were lifted. So the Houthis marched in the streets and protested against these subsidies being lifted, calling for the subsidies to be returned. And a lot of people marched with them and joined them. And so when the government responded and returned these subsidies, people felt like the Houthis were this force on the ground that were calling out for what everyone really wanted, if that makes sense. They weren't joining them because they believed in their ideology. They were joining them because they were speaking what's, you know, on the people's minds at the time. Now, I mean, the Houthis in terms of ideology are very much aligned with Iran. They are Zaydi Shias. And so in this conflict, they've received some support from Iran. And they've also used this war to recruit. So when there's been bombing in northern Yemen, bombing from the air, because the Saudi-led coalition has been in charge of Yemen's airspace for the last 6 years, they've been able to use that narrative to make people join them, because they've been seen as this force on the ground that is fighting against this foreign intervention from the air.
You have been reporting on this devastating war for the past 6 years. You were able to get into Yemen in April 2020 when COVID was raging around the world. And you said that when you got to Sana'a, Yemen's capital, the Houthis required you to attend a press conference on the COVID situation. And they also assigned you a minder to go with you basically wherever you went. Can you just talk about what is it like to actually get into Yemen to do this reporting?
So getting into Yemen over the last 6 years has been incredibly difficult because, like I said, the coalition is in charge of the airspace and they haven't allowed any foreign flights to land in northern Yemen, which is the region the Houthis control, for the last 6 years. So first of all, you need to get permission from the government in Saudi Arabia. And unfortunately, we weren't able to get that permission. And that's why I had to go in alone with my Yemeni passport. And then I drove to Houthi territory, which is about 15 hours away. And it's a very treacherous journey. And then when I made it to northern Yemen, which is where the Houthis are in control, you know, I arrived, I think, around end of June 2020, and COVID had started spreading in April. And from April till June, they had only announced four COVID cases. So this just gives you an idea of why they were so tense when I'd asked to report about COVID. So they'd only announced four cases. There was a huge cover up. There was barely any reporting done on the COVID situation in Yemen, and no one knew what was going on. At the time, they were saying that COVID didn't exist in Yemen. And so as soon as I arrived and I told them I want to cover the COVID situation, it was incredibly tense, and it took 2 weeks of negotiating with them for them to actually allow me to start filming. And so they assigned me a minder, and straight away they set up this press conference and said I must attend. And in this press conference, you know, they talk about it was meant to be an update on the COVID situation, but the minister makes no mention of COVID whatsoever. He talks about the war. He talks about the blockade. He talks about how the hospitals and the health system is collapsing. And then at the end, after it was around a 2 hour press conference, I stood up and I said, okay, but what about the COVID situation? You know, tell me about how many people have been infected with COVID, how many people have died. And you see this in the film. He just shuts down completely and says, you know, we don't want to scare people. That's why we're not talking about COVID, because we don't want to do what other countries have done. And when you start talking about numbers and talking about who's infected and who isn't, you spread fear amongst the people, and this brings their immunity down. And then he just gets up and storms out of the press conference. And that was basically what the trip was like with the Houthis for the rest of the trip.
In fact, there's one scene of you going to a market to interview people on the streets and shopkeepers, and you were approached by a Houthi informant who told you not to record anything about the virus.
Yeah, I mean, it was really surreal. It was just those, you know, I really thought I was going in to make a film about the humanitarian situation and about how difficult it is in such a poor country to deal with COVID, especially since I'd experienced it in the UK. And so, you know, it was the same experience, but in a completely different place. And that's why I was so fascinated to see how Yemen would deal with it. But I never imagined it to be something that was, it became so hostile to cover, you know. Usually it's like the political stories that are hostile, you know, if you're covering terrorism, for example, or if you're covering, like the political stories. But this was a humanitarian story that became so dangerous to cover. And it's because of how much they were clamping down on anyone who mentioned the word COVID. And when we go into this market, me and my team are the only people in an entire busy market that are wearing face masks. And, you know, I'd been in the country for around 3 weeks now. I'd heard the stories from people in their homes telling me how many have died of COVID, how many were sick of COVID. And so I knew it existed. But we go into this busy market, no one's wearing a face mask, because if you wear a face mask, you're basically admitting that you believe COVID exists, and that puts you in danger. And as soon as he saw me wearing a face mask, and I asked the shopkeeper about COVID, this Houthi minder comes in right away. No, he's not the minder, actually. He was like a police, basically Houthi police, undercover police in the area. And he shut the interview down right away.
Now, when the Houthis, the officials said that there were only four cases, doctors told you that hospitals were full, many people had died, and many health workers and doctors had lost their lives at that point. And that was early in your trip.
Exactly. I mean, it was quite surprising because it was so difficult to get people to speak outside the hospitals. But when we finally got permission to go into the hospitals, the first thing I did was go to the ICUs, because I knew that when I go into the ICUs, all these minders wouldn't come in with me. Because even though they were denying that COVID existed, they knew it existed and they didn't want to go in and get infected in the ICU. And so it was kind of, the intensive care units became the safe space to get answers from the doctors with no minders around. And so straight away, we speak to this doctor, Dr. Rania Jayashan, who was this incredible woman in Al Kuwait Hospital in Sana'a. And she tells us about how the hospital was overflowing with patients at the height of the pandemic. And how, you know, and this was a really well-equipped hospital because it was covered by MSF, Doctors Without Borders, but it's only one, you know, that has that kind of funding. All the other hospitals weren't as well-equipped. But they really struggled, and you could see how much trauma the doctors had been through because they were working on something, like doctors all around the world were celebrated for dealing with COVID and being on the front line. You know, here in the UK, we had clap for doctors, clap for the NHS, and I'm sure in the US as well, you know, doctors have been celebrated. But in Yemen, they were made to feel like criminals because not only were they a part of what has been said to not exist, but secondly, they were blamed for all the deaths. They were rejected by their families because they were seen as infected and by communities, as they were seen as the people bringing in the disease into neighborhoods rather than the people treating the disease. So it was really, really sad to see what they'd been through and to hear from them.
Well, do you know if these medical workers will pay any price for speaking on camera? In addition to the doctor you just talked about, you also spoke with Dr. Iheb Sakoff, an epidemiologist, who said that in the beginning, COVID just spread so rapidly. He said that his team was reporting COVID numbers to the Ministry of Health, but publicly the ministry continued to deny that the virus even entered northern Yemen. So these people are very brave for going on camera and telling the truth.
No, they're incredibly brave. And you know, we really had to kind of discuss our duty of care towards them after this film goes out. And we chose doctors who have a certain level of protection, either because they come from really well-known families or they know, you know, people that will be able to protect them. We were really careful about which doctors we chose to spoke to. And we also made sure that no doctor revealed numbers because we knew that if they put a solid number, if they say a solid number on camera, you know, that could get them in serious, serious trouble. So we knew there was like, you know, some lines I couldn't cross in my questioning with these doctors. And thankfully, you know, I'm still in touch with these doctors until today. They haven't received, they haven't gone, you know, they haven't had to face any trouble in Yemen, which is great. But we were really careful about which doctors we spoke to. And we made sure they were people who could protect themselves.
Sorry. We're speaking today with Nawal Al-Mahafi, who is originally from Yemen, and she has been covering the devastating war there for the past 6 years. She and her team are out with a very important documentary called Yemen's COVID Cover-Up, and you can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Nawal will be with us for about 10 more minutes, so if you have any questions or comments for her about what is happening in Yemen, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Another doctor you interviewed, Nawal, this really amazing young 26-year-old, said that he was getting up to $200 in pay until March, last March, and then his salary was cut off. The WHO stopped paying doctors just as COVID hit Yemen and their funding was slashed. And he said in the beginning there was even no protective gear and a lot of doctors stopped going to work, but you were able to actually interview doctors who continued going to work, including this really amazing young 26-year-old.
Yeah, he's amazing, Dr. Tahir Qasim. So Tahir, I mean, he was really, really incredible, and his story is just so heartbreaking. But one of the worst things that happened before COVID broke out in Yemen is that aid to Yemen was cut drastically. First of all, aid to the WHO was cut, and obviously that kind of was a domino effect all over the world, but it really impacted the health situation in Yemen. And also the US cut its aid to Yemen as well. At the time, by around $70 million, which had a huge impact to the health situation too. And it just came at a really bad time because all of these aid cuts had to be implemented in March, and COVID started spreading. The height of the pandemic in Yemen was around April, May. So it was terrible timing. And, you know, doctors in Yemen, government doctors, haven't received a regular salary since the beginning of the war in 2016. And so they rely on this money that the WHO gives them, which is meant to be like a bonus, a supplement to their salary. But when you're not receiving a salary at all, it becomes all you can rely on. And this money is about $200 a month that they receive and they live on. And it's already, you know, it's very little money, but people rely on it to survive. So as the COVID pandemic hit, it was cut in March. And so they were left penniless, you know, they weren't getting paid at all. And Dr. Tahir and his, you know, he had a lot of colleagues, a lot of them had no choice but to stop working in the hospital and take on other jobs, whether it was building work or, you know, like any job to help their families survive. But Dr. Tahir was actually in the ICU when the first patients began to arrive. And he said, as soon as the patients began to arrive, I just couldn't turn my back on them. Mm. I had to stay. And so he gets, he's in this really difficult situation because his mom is single and he was the breadwinner for the family. And he used to take money back home to his family. And so his mother says, you know, you need to come back and work and, you know, get a job that pays because we need the money. And when he tells her that he can't return because he really can't leave the ICU since most of the doctors have fled, his family basically tell him to not come back. And so he ends up living in the hospital. And I was really shocked when I met him. He was telling me about COVID and telling me, and then I went upstairs and I said, you know, what was it like going back home? And he said, I never went back home because I lived in the hospital. Mainly because I couldn't afford to live outside. I can't afford food. And the manager of the hospital said I could stay in one of the rooms upstairs. And he brought us food every day. So I stayed here. It was really heartbreaking. But his story is one of many. You know, it really reflects what a lot of the doctors in Yemen are having to go through right now.
And he told you, it doesn't matter that I'm exhausted. What's important are the people of my country. Another healthcare worker I'd love for you to talk more about is Nurse Makea. You went to Aslam, which is 180 miles from Sana'a. And as you report, mm-hmm. this region has been hit so hard by Saudi airstrikes. In 2020, there were almost twice the amount of airstrikes as the year before. And we should say that many of those airstrikes involved United States-made bombs. So this area has just been devastated. You reported on one airstrike that hit a convoy of cars. It wounded 15 people and killed 8 children. Nurse Makea, another amazing person, she runs the only clinic in the area. And Nawal, this was just such a difficult part of the film to watch because you interviewed parents of malnourished children. And we actually see Hassan, who's just 8, who's just so thin and just, I mean, he can't even talk anymore because the malnourishment has really affected his development. I mean, he can't hear properly.
I mean, it's really difficult. You know, Hassan, like he's not the first child that I film in that state. It's just become such a widespread problem in Yemen. But it's never any less heartbreaking each time we meet a child like that. It was really, really difficult. Dr. Makea is absolutely incredible, but she too has been impacted by these aid cuts. And meeting Hassan, I think what made this trip different to all my previous trips is when I got to this clinic, it actually wasn't so busy. Usually when I go to these malnutrition clinics, and I'd been to the same one a year before, they're packed with kids. And so I thought, you know, is the situation getting better? And it didn't make sense because there's aid cuts, food prices are even more expensive now. So, you know, it's obvious that things should be getting worse. And she was like, no, of course things aren't getting better. But now, because of the aid cuts, we no longer pay for the fuel for families to bring their kids here. And so families can't afford to bring their kids here. You know, they can't afford to bring them here for treatment. It's one clinic in a very, you know, like it's the only clinic in a very huge area in Yemen. And so travel to it, it's so expensive. And so it was really heartbreaking. And then we met Hassan, and Hassan apparently has come numerous times. And so I asked her, I said, why does he keep coming back? And Dr. Makia tells us, you know, like all the kids in Yemen right now, that as soon as they leave the doors of this clinic, they receive no support. And so the support is really short-lived. You know, he'll receive treatment in the clinic, he'll be fed, he'll get better, but then he'll go home and then he won't have any food again. Mm. And it's just like this ongoing cycle. And so it's really devastating, but he is one of millions of children in Yemen that are suffering just like him. And it makes you think, you know, Hassan, the impact the malnutrition has had on him means he can't hear or speak. And it will continue to have, you know, an impact on his development. But there's an entire generation of children that are growing up in the same way that Hassan is. And so if something isn't done to end this war and to save those children, you know, it will be felt and it will have a lasting effect for a very long time in Yemen, because this is what the new generation is having to survive.
Noel, we're getting a lot of emails from listeners who want to know how to help. Sharon says, is there a reliable agency to distribute food and aid for families with children that won't be diverted by the Houthis?
There is. I mean, all the organizations, you know, charities that are very well known, like UNICEF, WHO, the MSF, like all these agencies are doing such incredible work on the ground. There's Oxfam, Save the Children. And although, of course, like in any war zone, there's always a hindrance in distribution of aid, the aid does get there. And we've spoken to multiple aid agencies. They do face struggles, but at the end of the day, the aid does get to the people who need it. So I know we speak a lot about how the Houthis are making it difficult for aid to be distributed, how the blockade is making it difficult for aid to get into the country. But, you know, it still does. It's just we're trying to highlight issues to put pressure on them to not do that anymore. But aid agencies wouldn't continue to take people's money and wouldn't remain in the country if they weren't able to distribute aid. And it really is, it comes back to lack of funding more than anything.
Can you tell us more about this? Because the blockade in the Hodeidah port, the Saudi coalition imposed a blockade there for 5 years to stop the Houthis from bringing in arms. And so as you report, supplies, medicine, food, fuel has been largely cut out. I mean, as you report, it can take months for goods to come in. So can you just talk a little bit more about how aid actually does get in?
So basically, I mean, a lot of the food and fuel that comes into Yemen, and I'm talking about commercial goods, can spend months before it gets in. And that means you pay more for cargo ships, you pay more for fuel, because if fuel takes so long to come in, when it comes in, by the time it gets in, it's really expensive. And so so when you go into a supermarket, the price of a bottle of milk, for example, is now around 8 times the price it was before this war began. And so for the average Yemeni who's now receiving only $100 a month, they can't afford a bottle of milk. And so that's why they're suffering. So the blockade has made food prices really, really expensive. It also means that aid agencies are having to spend more on delivery and on fuel to distribute the aid than on the food itself, because they have to pay these prices too. Right. And when you've got lack of funding, that means they're bringing in less food. And so less food is reaching people who need it, and more people need it because more people can't afford to feed themselves anymore because of that blockade. So I'm trying to make it as simple as possible. But then the aid agencies have done, you know, there's really smart ways of distributing aid now like instead of giving someone a bag of flour, you give them, and because that bag of flour is so difficult to get to them, you give them cash to go and make, you know, to go and buy their own flour. And by giving them cash, that means this aid is also pumping money into the economy and bringing up more jobs in Yemen, which means more people will be able to work to distribute that bag of flour. And that's what aid agencies are doing now. They're focusing on around, I think it's more than half of the aid money now goes to giving people cash, making sure they're buying food with that cash, and trying to pump money into the Yemeni economy rather than giving them flour that we've shipped in from outside.
Thank you all for the questions, and we'll put links for aid agencies at yourcallradio.org. We have a question from Bill who says, do you know why the Yemeni government is trying to hide the effects of COVID?
So the Houthi authorities, I really do not understand why, but my assumption is when you have a problem and you have no means to deal with it, and so the only thing you're doing by admitting that it exists is disappointing the people you're meant to be governing, the easier option is to pretend it doesn't exist. And so then people are dying and people don't know why they're dying. But you can't say we have a COVID problem. This disease is spreading across the country. The only way to stop it from spreading is for everyone to be locked down at home. When you have no alternative for the people, you know they're all going to starve at home. You can't, you know, if the economy stops for one day in Yemen, that's another, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that will starve. And so they can't do anything for the people. They're going to die anyway. And they also can't say there's a disease spreading and we can't even pay doctors to stay in the hospitals. And so I think the logic is they don't have the capacity to do anything about it. So denying it is the easiest option. I think that was the logic. They say their response to this question is that countries around the world kept saying numbers, and all that did was spread fear amongst the people. And that fear brings people's immunity down and makes them more susceptible to dying from the virus, which any scientist can tell you is complete rubbish, basically.
And the last question, the doctor that we spoke about, Dr. Makia, who does her best to treat malnourished children. She said, stop the war and we'll have food and resources. All these countries are desperate to find a vaccine. Can't they find a vaccine to end this war? Last month, President Biden said that the United States will finally end support for the Saudi-led invasions of Yemen and the war on Yemen. Do you think this will make a difference?
I think it will make a huge difference. And I really think that the U.S. can play such an important role in putting pressure on the warring sides to sit around a negotiation table and think of a peace deal. The problem is with so many external powers supporting this war and it will keep going on. We need the external powers to put pressure on the Yemenis that are at war with each other to end the war. And also, you know, the warring factions in Yemen can't afford to keep this war going without the support of the external actors. So it just can't go on without their support. So with the US pulling out, that's already one external actor that will stop giving arms to the Saudis, and that's less bombs that they'll be given and less bombs that can be dropped in Yemen. And it gives them more of an incentive to want to end this war themselves. And it already has. The Saudis have responded to it and have said that, you know, they're ready to think about a peace deal. And it's already having a very positive impact in the last couple of weeks.
Well, Nawal, thank you so much for this really incredible documentary. Thanks for your reporting. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you. Nawal Al-Mahafi is a frontline correspondent and an award-winning reporter and filmmaker. And I hope you can take some time to watch the documentary. It's just under 30 minutes. It's called Yemen's COVID Cover-Up. And you can find the link at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Washington Post reporter Hannah Denham about her latest piece, Millions Couldn't Afford Diapers Before the Pandemic. Now diaper banks in the U.S. can't keep up. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and now we are going to talk about the ongoing economic crisis in the United States with Hannah Denham, a national business reporter on the Washington Post's breaking news team. Hannah has an important piece out called Millions Couldn't Afford Diapers Before the Pandemic. Now diaper banks can't keep up. Without federal aid, diaper banks struggle to keep up with skyrocketing need and fewer donations. Hannah reports that requests have doubled, tripled, and even quadrupled at some locations, with diaper shortages and families lining up for hours in some communities. Chelsea Presley, founder and executive director of the Diaper Bank of the Delta in Mississippi, said, quote, "I see parents not putting anything on their babies because they don't have diapers. I've seen people use shopping bags with some rags in it. I've seen t-shirts. I've seen people keeping the diapers on longer than necessary, and the diapers sag down when the babies walk," end quote. Diaper banks are also seeing huge spikes for other hygiene products, especially for senior citizens. Joining us now is Hannah Denham, a national business reporter on the Washington Post's breaking news team. Hi, Hannah. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for writing this important piece.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, how did you become aware of this crisis, and how did you become aware of these diaper banks across the country?
Sure. So I've been reporting over the past 6 to 8 months of a lot of the economic fallout that we've seen from the coronavirus pandemic and mass layoffs. And something that I've covered with some of my colleagues at the Post is how debt, hunger, food insecurity, and eviction is really impacting families in need that may have been comfortable financially or may have been on the brink of poverty before a year ago, but are now since then have just been pushed into really desperate situations. And something that I found in my reporting on shoplifting, families who are shoplifting food and necessities, one of the highest or most often stolen good or diapers and baby formula. So I just really wanted to sort of get at the sense of, okay, what's going on here in the broader scope? And I was able to connect with the National Diaper Bank Network and find out more through that way.
Oh, you worked on and wrote that piece about shoplifting?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow. I remember that. I just found it. Oh, my gosh. I remember that piece. You wrote that in December called Stealing to Survive: More Americans Are Shoplifting Food Aid or Food as Aid Runs Out During the Pandemic.
Yes, yes. That was a really hard and difficult thing to write. And I think that the issue here is that people are so desperate in this situation of poverty and immense economic struggle is just, it impacts people in intersectional ways. And that's what we found with the diapers as well.
I mean, this is incredible, Hannah. I actually thought about your piece for about a week. I mean, you reported that diapers, shampoo, laundry detergent began disappearing in big numbers because people just cannot afford the basics.
Right, right. And what we're seeing too in those situations where, you know, these are grocery stores or local bodegas, different kinds of stores where things are being stolen from. A lot of employees don't even have the heart to call the police to report them because they understand just how difficult financially is the situation a lot of people are in right now. So it is a difficult look at reality.
Wow, that was such an important story. In this piece, you report that historically, most diaper bank clients live below the poverty line, a federal threshold capped at $26,500 a year for a family of four. Again, $26,500 a year for a family of four. You report that one in three families could not afford diapers even before the COVID outbreak, and then the pandemic just made it worse.
Right, that's correct. And that number, one in three U.S. families, it seems really high, but that's even kind of outdated. I think the most recent study that was done, that was in 2013. So thinking about the past couple of years, the last year in particular, where families have been, and, you know, after the pandemic set in, millions of Americans lost jobs. We are descended into a recession that especially affected women, people of color, and low wage earners. And so these are already groups who are vulnerable to food insecurity, to debt, to eviction. So what we've seen over the past year is just the worsening of these situations.
You also report that no federal aid or welfare program covers diapers like WIC, SNAP, or cash assistance. And then states can distribute temporary assistance for needy family funds, but that's a fixed pot of money that legislators decide how to distribute.
Right, that's correct. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't know if you've never had to search for any sort of federal or public benefits to cover a lot of your necessities. But none of the current federal welfare programs cover diapers. States can choose. There are some public child care programs, like some Head Starts, that may offer free diapers through their programming services. But as a whole, this is a gap in the support system that exists in the safety net, and it's not covered.
You spoke with a number of people who work at diaper banks across the country. I read the quote from Chelsea Presley, founder and executive director of the Diaper Bank of the Delta in Mississippi, who said that she sees people using shopping bags, t-shirts, because they can't afford diapers. First off, tell us about Chelsea Presley. She opened this diaper bank in 2016.
Right. So Chalisa Presley, she's based in northern Mississippi in Clarksdale. In 2015, she had been working for years as a social services worker. She was working as a doula, as a child safety car seat instructor. She worked with moms on lactation, but she realized that during that time when she was visiting families in the community and working with them to meet their needs, one of the most prevailing needs was being able to afford diapers. So she met with a group, a small group of community advocates in Clarksdale, and in 2015, they organized a drive outside a local Walmart, and were able to raise $2,000 and a couple truckloads of diapers and wipes, and that provided the seed for Diaper Bank of the Delta, which was opened a year later in 2016. So her work has extended far beyond Clarksdale, far beyond northern Mississippi, just because of skyrocketing need. And a lot of times what Chalisa told me is diapers is sort of the first step to addressing a family or a mom or an individual's broader needs. So women may come in because they need diapers, but they stay because they have opportunities to get their GED or get their driver's license or find employment. And so a lot of what Chalice and other diaper bank directors told me is a lot of times diapers are sort of that first step.
This particular diaper bank in Mississippi gave away 75,000 diapers in 2019 and then 300,000 in 2020. And they, like so many diaper banks across the country, got hit so hard by the pandemic. She hasn't taken a paycheck since March.
Right. In total, 2020, Diaper Bank of the Delta gave away 300,000 diapers. So that, what she told me, that's four times as many as the year before. So just talking about skyrocketing need, they expanded their services all throughout the state to Biloxi, to the coast, to community colleges, to communities in the state, undocumented families who were sort of swept up in the ICE raid a year and a half ago, to those families who need diapers as well. So their services have really expanded because of how much need, how many requests for diapers are pouring in.
And since we're talking about Mississippi, we should also say, because of those horrible winter storms, which took out power sources throughout the U.S. South, there are many parts of Mississippi where they don't have water. This morning on NPR, one woman said that this is overwhelmingly affecting Black communities. And I'm just reading a piece from The Guardian right now. In Jackson, Mississippi, where 80% of residents are Black, the cold led to breakages in the city's aging pipes, leaving thousands of people without running water. They've been out without running water for weeks now.
Right, that's correct. And Chalisa and her team have been down in Jackson the past week, actually. She's been tough to get in touch with because she's working so hard with those communities who are struggling because of the storms, as you mentioned, to get their basic needs. So including diapers, including water. So it just, again, shows sort of this grassroots support system that is wonderful in the work that they do, but also sort of highlights the bigger need for sustainable aid.
Exactly. And it is wonderful work at the grassroots, but how sustainable is this? You write in your piece that some of these corporations are giving a lot of diapers and they're giving money, but that's not sustainable. How long is that going to last? And also it's important to talk about the underlying issues about why so many people are in need in the first place.
That's definitely correct. I mean, the sort of structure that exists right now with the diaper banks, you have a handful, about 220 diaper banks across the country that operate sort of under the umbrella of the National Diaper Bank Network. And so the network nationally will distribute a lot of the funding and donations they receive from Kimberly Clark, who's the owner of Huggies and You by Kotex. So this network also distributes menstrual products and adult incontinence products. But that's sort of the structure, but it relies heavily on corporate giving, on individual donations, on, you know, individual volunteers that show up at these diaper banks to even pack diapers to distribute them to community partners. And so a lot of this is, as you're saying, right, it's not sustainable. And what advocates and diaper bank directors are really begging for is government funding, some sort of public aid when volunteer and small donor aid dry up like they have in the past year.
Right. And to ensure that people are paid a living wage, you just reminded me this morning, Bernie Sanders introduced an amendment to force politicians to vote on a $15 minimum wage. And he and a number of Democrats who support the measure were speaking this morning. And Hannah, I mean, this just, again, it's another example of why people are so desperate for aid right now, some sort of financial relief. Because as you write in your piece, the last round of relief brought 17 million people out of poverty, but now they've been waiting for months.
Right, right. I think it shows this too. Diaper need is just sort of a snapshot into the bigger story of poverty, of economic instability that exists, that existed before 2020, but that I think the pandemic has really, really exposed. And so something that was interesting that I learned from Corinne Cannon, who's the diaper bank director of the Greater DC Diaper Bank, she said that a lot of the families on their diaper banks rolls have been there since the 2009 Great Recession. So these families, when they're hit by a big recession, a big economic event of instability like this one, they don't recover right away. They don't recover when the vaccine comes or when the jobs come back. It takes years and years to get back up on your feet after the sort of and death that you face. And so I think that just highlights how diaper need here, this is a crisis that is a marker of recession and is sort of a worrisome look at, I guess, the future economically of the country moving forward post-pandemic.
Hannah Denham is a national business reporter on the Washington Post breaking news team, and we're talking about a piece she wrote called Millions Couldn't Afford Diapers Before the Pandemic. Now diaper banks can't keep up. And if you have any questions for Hannah, any comments on this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You also report, Hannah, that diaper need can have significant health implications because keeping babies and toddlers in diapers for too long or washing and reusing disposable diapers can lead to painful rashes, urinary tract infections, and even emergency room trips.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, think about it, how necessary diapers are. But if you're a parent who's choosing between, you know, buying food and buying diapers, you're going to go with what seems the more immediate, you know, you're going to buy food. But that means really having to make do with limited resources to keep your babies clean and dry. In addition to sort of the health impacts on children that keeping them in diapers too long can have. Also, a Yale University study found that diaper need is a major indicator of maternal stress and depression. Because if moms feel like they cannot provide for their children, it has long-term impacts on their mental health, on their health overall, and that can have an effect on the child's development, and it can increase their likelihood as well for multi-generational poverty. So I think it just shows the interconnectedness of what happens when a basic necessity is not met.
Exactly. And you report that diaper banks are also seeing huge spikes for other hygiene products, especially for elderly people. Michelle Old, founder of the Diaper Bank of North Carolina, said diaper distributions jumped 400%, while those for menstrual and adult incontinence products swelled 800% and 2,000% respectively.
Yep, that's correct. I mean, something that these diaper banks do, they're not only diapers for babies, but they're distributing menstrual products for women and girls. They're distributing products as well for anyone who is menstruating, as well as for adult incontinence supplies. So I think this need, it's not just about it. I mean, it's largely about children, but I think this has a much broader impact than you may think firsthand. And I think this is also sort of the issue when people bring up, well, why not cloth diapers? Why are we using disposable diapers in the first place? You have to sort of look at the full picture. Like, this is not just for children. This is what you're asking and expecting of our seniors, our elderly, people who are disabled, and people who are menstruating. And so I think that the impact of this is a lot broader in terms of need and what's accessible and convenient.
And another point about cloth diapers, you report that a lot of groups get pushback for not using cloth diapers, but they do that because childcare centers only accept disposables, and cloth diapers are prohibited at laundromats and laundry rooms in apartment complexes. So that's an important point to make.
It is, right? If you're a single mom who's working three jobs and in a one room apartment, and you don't have your own washer and dryer, and you can't wash cloth diapers at the local laundromat, then you know it's not a feasible option for you when your resources and your time is pressed. So I think you know, there are a lot. Most of the diaper banks, the directors that I spoke with, do offer cloth diapers to families. But it's something that families can choose. And families who do choose to use cloth diapers, who are able to stay at home with their children or have other sort of childcare arrangements, they, you know, it of course saves money, it's more environmentally sustainable. But I think it's just a matter of, if it's hard to speak to this unless you are truly that parent who is in that desperate situation.
How are lawmakers responding to this? When you look at what's going on in other parts of the world, Scotland became the first in the world to make sanitary products free to anyone who needs them. This was last November. And then New Zealand, just last month, announced that it will offer free sanitary products at schools to fight period poverty. What about here in the United States? You report on a bill, the COVID Diaper Assistance Act, that would devote $200 million to the Social Services Block Grant Program. What else are lawmakers doing to deal with this crisis?
Right. So that bill is a bipartisan bill that has been introduced a couple times and has failed in the chamber. A similar bill has been introduced in the House that has also not passed yet, obviously, or I would not be writing about this, I think. But in this case, I think it's there's no federal support at this point, despite a handful of lawmakers who are seeking to address this in a legislative way. I think there is more support on the state level, from what my reporting shows. There are a handful of states who tax hygiene products like menstrual products or like diapers. There are a couple other states in California specifically, Help a Mother Out, the diaper bank in the Bay Area, was the first and, from what I understand, the only diaper bank to receive any sort of public funding. So they receive allocated state funding for diapers through the city and county of San Francisco. But that's definitely an outlier. And it's not a program that is impossible to implement. It's just something where we're really not seeing. And it's hard to say why.
Hannah, can you tell us which politicians are opposing these bills?
You know, I don't know if I can, I don't know the specifics of that, but I think it's just, what the National Diaper Bank Network, what their advocates and sort of policy affairs representatives have said, that when they seek to lobby, you know, state representatives and federal Congress for diaper funding, you know, whether that's in stimulus aid from the pandemic or even before the pandemic, the biggest question, they get questions about cloth diapers. Like I said, they also just hear a lot of in a negative feedback sense, pushback on, well, why are these families having babies in the first place if they're poor? So I think a lot of there's a lot of misunderstanding about the complexity of poverty. And so I think that's one reason, one idea of why there's pushback to something that seems more simple.
I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm wondering if those questions, why are people having these children, are coming from, you know, the so-called pro-life, pro-family, anti-choice politicians. I'd like I said, I don't want to put you on the spot, but it's just, can you tell us, we have about 30 seconds left. Since you've done all this reporting on the economy, we're in this debate now about giving people just some sort of relief so they can actually buy their families food and diapers. Any idea where this relief bill is going? Sorry, but we only have about 30 seconds left.
Sure. I'm not sure yet. I think it's something that many have been frustrated by how it's been held up, while, you know, really desperate families, as we see in this story and other coverage, are just doing what they have to get by day to day. But I think it's something we just have to keep watch over and continue to support other networks in the meantime while we wait for solutions.
Well, Hannah, thank you so much for your important reporting, and thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hannah Denham is a national business reporter for the Washington Post's breaking news team, and I hope you can check out her story, Millions Couldn't Afford Diapers Before the Pandemic, and Now Diaper Banks Can't Keep Up. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.